The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond. The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Less screen time, more play time. Pause the internet with our new Sky Broadband Buddy app.
Billy Connolly, good morning to you.
Good morning.
How are you doing over there?
I'm pretty good, Ryan. The sun's blazing down. I've got no complaints.
Well, you're missing a very Celtic, leafy, autumn, sunny, crisp day in Ireland. I don't know if you're missing it, but just to tell you, to swap weather stories, that's what's happening here.
You're welcome to it.
Yeah. It's funny. Yesterday, I was in Dublin and I was doing a show from a beautiful house in a place called Henrietta Street. It used to be a tenement, and sitting among the crowd was Ronnie Drew's son, Phelim. And I was thinking, Phelim Drew's dad, Ronnie, would have loved to have spoken to you today. You knew him, didn't you?
I was a great friend of his.
And
he was a great hero of mine.
Yeah, tell me about him.
I loved the way he sang. Nobody sang like Ronnie Drew, but also his view on life was pretty good.
Yeah.
He was a lovely man.
Didn't you record a song together?
Yes, we did. It's called Sergeant, Where's Mine? It was an anti-recruiting, army recruiting song.
And you would have been pretty well matched with some of the hairy banjo players in that band anyway.
Absolutely. They were a lovely hairy band. I remember the first time I saw them in Glasgow. I couldn't believe it. They looked like dwarves when they came out on the stage.
It was the Glasgow City Hall in the 60s. Is that when you saw them first?
That's right. I remember they did Rose and Dew. It changed my life.
Well, there's one man standing from the Dubliners. His name is John Sheehan. And we had a big, big Late Late Show special for him last year. And I tell you what, he's what you'd call a national treasure. A wonderful man, still playing.
He's a wonderful guy, and his knowledge of poetry is amazing.
Yeah. For sure. I'm only asking you a little bit about your Irish background, Billy, because your book Tall Tales and Wee Stories weaves in and out of your life through different anecdotes and stories. And we have to go back a few greats now, a great, 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 to get to Charles Mills and Bartholomew Valentine Connolly. And we're going to Connemara, the beautiful Connemara in the west coast of Ireland.
Yes, I visited there. I don't know, I didn't meet anybody from my family line, but I visited all the places. It was lovely.
Do you think you got any of your storytelling ability from the west coast of Ireland, or do you attribute it purely to the mean streets of Scotland and Glasgow?
I think it was Glasgow, but the Irish influence in my family was huge, and so I suppose it rubbed off. I always loved the way they spoke. The entertainment in the conversation was lovely.
The other person I want to mention, Billy, is because you not too long ago you had been in Dublin, probably 6-7 years ago, and Shay Healy, one other great favourite of ours, asked you to do something for him, and suddenly your lives were interconnecting for all the most peculiar reasons, really.
It was remarkable. He asked me to do a publicity thing for the Parkinson's Society.
Mm.
And he had done it because I made my name on the Parkinson show in England. And we posed for pictures and did this Parkinson thing. And a month later, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's. So I've always blamed him of giving me it.
Well, he'll appreciate the humour in that, I'm sure. When you were diagnosed first, were you scared or were you stoical?
I was pretty stoical because I was diagnosed with cancer the same day.
Only you could laugh like a drain about that, yeah.
It wasn't a good day.
What do you do at the end of a day like that?
That was the weekend I got hearing aids as well.
So let's itemize that. Parkinson's, cancer, and hearing aids in the course of a couple of days. How do you process that?
Absolutely. I was kind of confused and bewildered. I wondered what I'd done to deserve it. But it all worked out at the end.
You've said in the past, you said, Billy, you get slyer as you get older. What does that mean?
I get sneakier.
How?
I think people see it as wisdom, but you just get sneakier.
And what are you being sneaky about, and how do you practice the sneakiness?
Well, it's hard to give you examples, but it's you get slyer as you get older. And instead of kicking up a fuss about getting what you want, you find quiet ways to defy people.
How are you feeling these days? How's your health? I'll ask you straight out. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Even as we speak, my left hand is shaking. But I forgot to take my medicine this morning. But the medications I'm on are doing me great good.
You said once upon a time, not too long ago, I don't find it healthy to swim in Parkinson's. Could you kind of explain that a little bit to us?
I don't know what it means.
I presume it means...
I don't absorb myself in it. I don't go to Parkinson's Society meetings and talk about it.
Yeah.
It becomes overwhelming and it very easily. They're very sociable, the Parkinson's people. They have a great social circuit where they all gather without me.
You just don't want to get involved in that sort of thing, is that it?
I don't want to think about it all the time.
I can understand that entirely.
I don't want to look at people who are worse off than me and think, oh, I'm going to be like that. So I avoid it.
Writing your book, you've said that you've resisted ever writing down your tall tales and wee stories, and you added you couldn't quite bear to look at your own words on the page. Why not?
In case they didn't find them funny. They came as ad-libs and grew and grew and grew. I would ad-lib and add to it as the nights went on. I would add and add and add, and it would become something different from the way it started out. And then I would change and drop it and do other stuff. But when it came to the book, the publishers took it from my tapes, and because I didn't have any written information on it, I never wrote it down.
And were you one of those performers, Billy, who just ran to the stage with excitement, or did you stumble up to the stage dreading it?
Well, I did the dreading thing in the dressing room, and the walk from the side of the stage to the microphone, I changed and got to like it. It was a remarkable thing. I've often phoned home and saying, I can't go on, I've got no ideas, I don't know what to say. Make my family feel terrible and then walk on and have the time of my life. It's very weird.
It is weird, but
you... walk from the wings to the microphone, it changed completely.
And you transform into somebody comfortable and in charge and on fire.
Absolutely. Your voice gets a kind of changes pitch, and it sort of goes up a little notch, and the atmosphere that the audience gives you enables you to start and go on with it. It's a remarkable thing.
The way you speak, it reminds me of a friend of ours who's quite shy to meet in real life. And soon as he goes on stage, it's like he's transformed. I'm talking about Christy Moore.
Oh, yeah. Christy's a great example of that. Tommy Tiernan is the same. He's a quiet, nice, wise guy, and then when he goes on stage, he becomes this crazy animal.
Did you find you were a better performer when you were drinking?
No. I didn't find much change in my performance from when I stopped drinking, because I never drank before going on stage. Always after. I finished very bravely, but drink into the night. So it didn't really affect the way I did my show.
And do you miss it?
My wife would disagree with that.
Yeah, I'm sure she would. I'll talk to her. We spoke to her once before. We might do that again and compare notes. But do you miss that, Billy? Do you miss the stage, the light on you, the microphone, the storytelling in that sense?
I don't yet. I don't have any pangs at all. I don't miss it. I kind of miss the travelling and being in different towns and wandering around. I used to love wandering around people's towns before going on stage at night. Now, I miss that.
You know, when you talk to people down through the years, say in the 70s and 80s, when your career was just getting bigger and bigger, and you hide away a lot of problems, and that was the done thing then. Now everyone's very much about speaking about their lives, wearing them on their sleeves and so on. You had a lot of secrets that you had to keep buried away. Do you feel that you've been liberated from all of that now at the age you are, that harshness you had to endure as a youngster and as a young person?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I got rid of it by talking about it. I just unleashed it on the public and there's theirs to deal with now. But I'm glad I did it. It was especially the forgiveness part. You know, when you forgive the people for what they did to you, it releases you.
Because we've been talking on this programme and on the TV to a lot of people who were in a similar boat to you as a kid, when you were a child. And they always, unfortunately, a lot of them still, even in their, these people are younger, they're in their 30s and 40s, they still carry the shame. What would you say to them about that?
The shame has nothing to do with you. You're not to blame, you're the victim. But try the forgiveness. Try and forgive the person for what they did to you. It's remarkable. Even if they're dead, it doesn't matter.
What does the forgiveness do to you, to your heart, your shoulders, your head?
You can lift your head up. It releases you completely, especially from the shame. Because people get kind of upset by the fact that they've taken part in it. And that's what brings the shame.
And, of course, these people were forced into these situations. They weren't consenting participants at all.
Absolutely. It's very weird. It's very complex.
It seems to me, Billy, down through the years, that your marriage to Pam was a game changer, and you've said as much. You said marriage to Pam didn't change me, it saved me. How did it save you?
It's great. She told me the truth. I remember once she said, "I don't mind you drinking, but you drink such crap." and I began to look at the way I drank, and then I stopped drinking altogether. She just put it on the line.
Your own family, you've got grandchildren now?
Yeah, I've got two grandchildren.
You said something lovely that resonated with me, but I presume with most of our listeners this morning, especially given that you're talking to Ireland. You said all fathers should go fishing with their sons. Could you explain that lovely piece of advice?
Oh, yeah. I got it from my son, really. He was interviewed by a fishing magazine and said, "How do you feel about going fishing with your father?" And he said, "Everybody should go fishing with their dad because fishing takes such a long time. Do you get to the place you're going to fish, then the fishing, then the getting back?" He said, "So the daddy stuff," he said, "lasts about an hour. And after that, you have to talk. You have to talk about everything. And it releases you. You get to speak and be honest with your dad. And you become your friend." So Jamie and I are pals. Though he's still my son, I'm still his dad. There's a part of him that's my pal. And it's worked out great.
And he was in recovery not too long ago, and you said that there was a lack of understanding and compassion shown towards addicts. Do you still believe that, Billy, or has that changed?
I think that's changed greatly. Jamie's been sober for 26 years, and so over that time it has changed radically. Everything has changed. There's a revolution going on in the sexual department as well. You know, all that stuff about transsexuals and bisexuals and... People are so much more tolerant now. Now people go on talk shows and they say I'm gay and the audience bursts into applause. I never thought I'd see that in my life.
And that's not just in the, you know, west coast of America. This has moved right over to Europe, broadly speaking, but in this country, in Ireland, very much so, and in your own hometown of Britain and Scotland, it's all changed utterly.
Radically. It's amazing. It's changed comedy. So now, you used to be able to be funny about gay people and all that. You can't do it anymore. I think it's a very positive development. And you can't speak about women the way... When I started in comedy, people were always talking about their wives who were so stupid and the mother-in-law was such a bat from hell. You don't do that anymore. And comedy's by far the better for it.
You know, the Scottish Nationalist Party are meeting this week, and Nicola Sturgeon and her friends are gathering to talk about Brexit and everything else. Now, you're probably sitting somewhere very beautiful and thinking about nothing like that. But does your eye ever cast itself across the newspapers? Do you ever think about Brexit? Do you care?
I care, but to a degree. I have great trouble understanding Brexit.
Yeah.
The people who got us into this position were such liars that I can't take it seriously.
How do you feel about Boris Johnson as Prime Minister?
Oh, Boris Johnson, Jesus. Don't start me.
Go on.
It's like having... Oh, no.
Go on. Give us a flavour of what's in your mind, Billy.
He's just a big, eaten, spoiled brat. He hasn't a clue about the people. Doesn't care. He was one of the liars.
You know, I often say, and I've been saying it to different people, particularly from the UK, that Brexit was voted in by the majority of British people, etc., etc. I mean, do you contend that they didn't... know what they were voting for? Is that where you're coming from?
That's where I'm coming from. They were lied to on a grand scale. There should be another referendum.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Do you feel in the States, for comedians particularly, that mocking Donald Trump is just a little easy?
It's massive. The mocking of Donald Trump is huge. And he sort of rides it like a surfer. It makes his followers stronger.
And do you think it's kind of lazy comedy now at this stage?
No, some of it is brilliant. Some of it is extraordinary. It's anything but lazy, but there's so much of it around.
And in terms of yourself and the future, Billy, what's the plan? I mean, obviously you have this book that everyone's going to love because it's like a literary version of what you've been saying and doing in the last 30, 40 years nearly. Where are you at in life now?
I'm sitting on the beach. I'm doing good. I go fishing and I draw. And I watch the television.
And what do you like to draw?
Well, it's kind of weird. I draw strange things. I draw people with blindfolds on, and that's kind of weird to describe.
That's okay. That's what you do on the beach in Florida. And we can see some of the drawings in the book, obviously. And what about travel and coming up across the water, maybe going back to Glasgow or coming to visit Dublin? Are you still in a position that you'd like to travel, or are you happy to stay put now for the foreseeable?
I'm happy to stay put for the foreseeable future. I will always travel, you know, but to a much lesser degree.
Would you describe yourself as happy?
Oh, yeah. If you change happy to content, you'll find that you're happier than you thought you were.
That'll do nicely. That's a nice way to end our conversation. Billy, what a pleasure to talk to you from Dublin to Florida this morning. I wish you the best of luck and good health, and thank you for your time and congratulations on the new book. Lovely to talk to you.
Lovely talking to you, Ryan.
Take it easy. Bye for now, Billy.
Bye-bye.
That's Billy Connolly joining us from Florida-sur-Mer, as we don't say, and his new book is called Tall Tales and Wee Stories, and he is one of those iconic comedians and figures in popular culture from the last 40 years and has always been a dear friend of Ireland's, and it's good to talk to him this morning, and we appreciate his time. Billy Connolly, Tall Tales and Wee Stories. The text number is always 51551.